Word of mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special fundraising edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. We've heard the horror stories, zebra mussels decimating the native clam population in the Great Lakes, the Asian longhorn beetles destroying trees here in the Northeast, nutria ravaging Louisiana's coastal marshes, and African killer bees on the attack in the Southwest. Invasive species are crisscrossing the globe and threatening biodiversity as we know it. Or are they? In his new book, Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasives Aren't All Bad, Dr. Ken Thompson argues that invasive species often cause far less damage than we might imagine, and that the cost of eradicating them often outweighs the benefits. Thompson was for 20 years a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield. Dr. Ken Thompson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi there.
Well, let's start with the question that you pose in the title of your book. Where do camels belong?
Well, I pose that question because it doesn't have a simple answer. Humans are very short-sighted kind of people. We never really look beyond, you know, the next election and quite often not beyond the end of next week, quite honestly. And so we assume that the way the world is today is the way it's always been. So we assume that something that's where it is now is where it's always been and where it should be. So most of your listeners won't know that camels evolved in North America and that there were dozens of species of camels that lived in North America for 40 million years and that they only went extinct in North America 8,000 years ago. So which is, you know, yesterday in geological time.
There were some definitions that were used back in the mid-19th century by a couple of notable British botanists who used this concept of native and alien when it came to species. Now, was this a scientific definition or was there something else at play here?
No, it was meant to be a scientific definition. They basically said if a species is where it is today and got there naturally on its own, then it's native. But if it was introduced by humans or in any way humans were involved in moving it to where it is now, then it's not native, then it's an alien. That was their definition. And that's really the definition we've stuck with ever since. We've kind of extended the sort of legal definition that we have in most countries of who is a legal citizen of that country.
Mm-hmm.
And we've tended to sort of extend that legal definition, you know, do you have the right kind of passport or not, to animals and plants. But they don't, you know, they haven't read the book, you know, they don't have passports.
It seems, though, that the definition of native changes depending on what is the perceived value of the species. In fact, you write about a British quote-unquote plant called Fritillaria meleagris. Tell us more about this plant.
Well, we have this particular problem in Britain because our entire flora and fauna only arrived here very recently at the end of the last ice age. and so we look at things and we often decide whether they're native or alien or not on the basis of whether we like them. So Fritillaria meleagris is a kind of conservation icon in Britain. It's a really pretty plant that grows in sort of hay meadows and things. And people spend lots of time conserving it. But in fact, it's really only been here a few hundred years, and it's a garden escape. It was originally brought into the country from Europe as an ornamental, but it's escaped into wild habitats, and now people use it as a kind of barometer of the value of those habitats because it's very attractive.
How far do you have to go back to establish belonging?
Well, exactly. Well, you tell me. I mean, I don't know. It depends what you're talking about, depends where you are in the world. I mean, you know, Australians are still having this argument among themselves about dingoes, you know. Are dingoes a native Australian animal or not, you know, because people took them to Australia, but that was about 5,000 years ago. So is that long enough? It depends very strongly on whether you like the plant or you like the animal.
Uh-huh, that's it. You point to in the book a beauty bias. Now, what do you mean by that? And how does that influence how we regard and how we talk about invasive species?
Well, we just adjust our definitions of what's native and alien, at least we do in this country, depending on what we like. So, I mean, almost all our arable weeds, our weeds of cereal crops in this country, are aliens because they were brought here by early farmers. So they were brought here by people. But because many of them are very attractive, things like poppies and so on, we tend to go around treating them as native. And there's nothing we like more as conservationists than as things that are pretty and rare. So we spend a lot of time conserving them. But they're not native.
So is our reaction to invasive species reactionary, or is something even more sinister? Is there a kind of xenophobia that goes with, you know, something came from the outside and it was probably carried by other people?
Yeah, I think maybe humans are basically xenophobic. Maybe our history means that we like people who are members of our family or of our immediate tribe, and we're just programmed to distrust or fear anyone or anything that isn't familiar, you know, and turns up unexpectedly.
We're talking with Dr. Ken Thompson. He's a longtime lecturer at the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield in England, now writes on gardening for the Daily Telegraph. And we're talking about his book, Where Do Camels Belong? It's a book questioning our beliefs and assumptions about invasive species. Are they all bad? Well, Dr. Thompson, you are, let's clarify that you are not advocating to welcome or accept all invasive species, or are you?
Oh, good Lord, no. I some people have criticized me for as though that's what I am saying, but I'm definitely not. I just think we should be a little more objective about this because, you know, a few alien species, you know, can be shown to cause real problems, real economic harm or real ecological harm. And those are the ones we should focus on. You know, we've only got enough, so much time and money to spend on this. Let's be honest, you know, we have more important things to worry about. And if we go around treating all alien species as though they need eradicating or controlling, then we're not going to do a very good job. We need to focus on the ones that really do cause a problem.
Well, how do we make that decision? Should we be more concerned about the recent invaders? I'm thinking of the zebra mussels or Asian carp or the long-horned Asian beetle here in New England than say, wild rabbits, which are a nuisance in England.
I don't think the time a species has been around has anything to do with it. I think we should just have some objective criteria where we add up the benefits and the problems that are caused by an alien species. You know, I mean, you mentioned zebra mussel now. Zebra mussels do a lot of good, quite honestly. We could go into details of exactly what they do.
Aren't they things that clog up pipes and can damage plumbing or stop it altogether?
Yeah, they can grow inside water pipes and things and cause a problem. But frankly, you know, there are fairly simple technical solutions for that. And in fact, they're great at filtering grot, you know, crud out of water. So they purify water. They're a great food source for water birds. They have a lot going for them, really.
But they killed off clams in many areas, haven't they?
Well, that's what people who don't like them claim. But, you know, the evidence for that is really quite poor, actually. And there's strong evidence that the clams that are declining were declining before the zebra mussel turned up. And mainly it's habitat change and it's pollution that's doing for the clams, not the zebra mussels.
We often focus on the ecological problems that invasive species cause. But in truth, are they man-made? Because that's often how they travel. You know, I guess I'm asking, have invasive species been scapegoated?
Oh, all the time. Many, many examples of where species are simply filling an ecological vacuum that's been caused by human activity. I mean, let's face it, mankind has completely transformed this planet. And to expect, quite honestly, that the species which lived in a particular place are going to be the ones best adapted to that spot now that mankind has changed it beyond recognition is frankly a little bit unreasonable, don't you think?
Any particular species come to mind that has been the most vilified?
Oh, the most vilified. Oh, heaven. Well, that depends entirely where you are.
Okay, there in the UK, let's say.
In the UK, you mentioned invasive species. people, if they're thinking of plants, they say Japanese knotweed. If you mention animals, most people would mention it. It's one of yours, I'm afraid. It's the American gray squirrel.
Mm.
That's the one people most hate.
All right. So we'll try and get over the anti-American bias of looking at the gray squirrel in that way. Well, in the book, you write about five myths about invasive species in which you refer to all of the species as aliens. Is there one in particular that really stands out for you as a myth that's led us down the wrong path?
The most important one, I suppose, was the idea that aliens are always amazingly expensive.
Hmm.
You know that they cost a lot of money. When I was researching this book, I found time and time again the costs that were attributed to an alien species were wildly exaggerated. They often never took account at all of any benefits of alien species, and the costs were often completely imaginary. The greater part of them was often costs spent on trying to control a species.
Hmm.
And although this should be obvious, but think about it for a moment. The costs of trying to control something cannot be a reason for trying to do that control in the first place.
What would be an example of that calculation?
Well, the example that I quote in the book is purple loosestrife.
This is a weed that's all over here in the
US. This is a weed that's all over North America, and it's one of ours. It's very well behaved here. if you look that up, you can find various estimates. The usual estimate is, which is quite old now, so probably it's a bigger figure, but $45 million a year is apparently what it costs, what people spend every year on actually trying to control purple loosestrife. But there's no real evidence that a single cent of that is money well spent. In other words, I don't think anyone's ever shown that there would be less purple loosestrife if those $45 million were not spent. So whether that's a real cost or not can definitely be argued, I think.
Well, all right, you can keep your well-behaved purple loosestrife in. We'll try and contain our gray squirrels here in the U.S. I want to thank you for opening up a really interesting topic for us, Dr. Thompson.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Ken Thompson. He was for 20 years a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield. His previous book was called Do We Need Pandas? The Uncomfortable Truth About Diversity. Equally provocative, his newest book, Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasive Species Are Not All Bad. You can find more on both at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's such an everyday act, opening up the fridge to grab a snack or a carton of milk. But let's take that carton and follow it back from the shelf through all the steps it took to get to the store where you bought it and the packaging it's in and how it got from farm to plant, maintaining the proper chill at every step. Artificial cooling accounts for a whopping 15% of the world's energy consumption and directly contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. is by far the world leader in household refrigerators, but China is on pace to overtake American cold storage consumption in the next decade. Nicola Twilley is currently working on a book about refrigeration. Her recent article for the New York Times Magazine asks, "What do Chinese dumplings have to do with global warming?" And she's here to help us understand both the question and the answer. Nicola, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
The luxury of owning a refrigerator and a freezer in the home is a relatively new one in China. Now, when did this cold storage boom, as you call it, first begin?
Well, at the start of the 90s, fewer than 1 in 10 Chinese people had a refrigerator in their home. Today, it's 95% of urban families. So that got started in the 90s and is really complete now. The other part of the refrigeration boom is the part you don't tend to see in your day-to-day life, which is refrigerated warehouses and refrigerated trucks and all of the sort of behind the scenes what the industry experts call the cold chain, which is a seamless network of refrigeration from farm to your refrigerator.
And that is what part of what your article details. But first, you write that now 95% of urban households in China do own a refrigerator. With such a small percentage of the population left, which I still know is significant in China, how much further does the cold storage boom have to go before it tops out?
Oh, it has a long way to go. First of all, those numbers are for urban Chinese. The situation in the countryside is very different. There is still fewer, it's a minority of people that have a refrigerator. So there's still a lot of growth, even just in the domestic refrigerator market. In terms of actual cold storage at the national level, if you think every single American has 13 cubic foot of refrigerated space per capita, that it's somewhere out there with your name on it. And a Chinese person, even after a decade's worth of this cold storage boom, has just under 4 cubic feet, so less than a third of what we have in the U.S., really. So there's a long way to grow.
Well, let's get back to this idea that introducing frozen food does not just, you know, happen at the point of getting from a store to a home refrigerator. It is an elaborate infrastructure getting a meal from a manufacturer to the dinner plate. This is what you referred to earlier as the cold chain. Can you just describe some of the stages in that chain?
Well, take a frozen dumpling, for example, which is the most popular frozen food in China. In the U.S., frozen pizza is by far and away the most popular frozen food. But Chinese people don't like cheese as a general rule. So it's the dumpling that has sort of been the gateway frozen food there. And that has to be made in the cold. It has to be flash frozen in a factory, has to be stored in that factory, kept freezing. When it's ready to go out, you need trucks that can keep it at freezing. They're going to distribute it to a warehouse, probably on the edge of the city somewhere, perhaps belonging to a Walmart, perhaps belonging to a different distributor or a wholesaler. And then from there, smaller trucks tend to take it into the city, either to a grocery store or, as is increasingly happening in China, direct to the consumers as people get they're sort of leapfrogging the supermarket stage and going straight into e-grocery shopping.
So a lot to be done, a lot of money to be made, and this has become a very important government-aided initiative. So what are some of the social benefits or health benefits to refrigeration?
Well, I think the main things are food safety. I mean, obviously, as we see in the headlines every day, food safety is a pressing issue in China, and refrigeration is and a seamless cold chain is one way to really cut down on that. There was a study done by a consulting firm that showed that Chinese consumers expect to have an upset stomach from bad food twice a week. That's totally normal for them. That's the average.
Wow.
And a lot of that is just from the fact that, I mean, currently in China, less than a quarter of meat is transported under refrigeration. The number for vegetables is 5%. So you can imagine that a lot of bad things are happening as that food travels from where it's grown to where it's going to be eaten. And refrigeration could help prevent a lot of that.
And also prevent waste.
That's the other big thing. At the moment, China throws away 40%, I mean nearly half actually, of what it grows. And it throws it away in that journey between the producer and then the retailer. So before a consumer ever gets to even see this, half of what China grows has been thrown away. And it's simply because it rots en route. You can't keep it fresh, especially in the summer. I went to the wholesale market that supplies 80% of Beijing's vegetables, and the farmers had packed individual heads of broccoli in ice and hay to try and keep it cold and insulated.
Uh-huh.
And they just dig out one head at a time and sell it to people. But you can't, the farmer told me he expects to lose a quarter of the truck in summer.
To create a flawless cold chain would take significant energy. Where is China sourcing most of its energy from now? Is it still coal?
Yes, it is still coal, unfortunately, so it's the dirtiest kind of energy. And it's not just electricity that is the problem, actually, with refrigeration. There's this the issue of what chemicals you use inside your refrigeration system. They're called refrigerants. And I think a lot of us thought we dealt with the refrigerant problem when we got rid of CFCs and we stopped, you know, forming the hole in the ozone layer in the 80s. But unfortunately, their replacements, HFCs, turn out to be sort of 1,000 times, if not more, some of them are even more warming than that, but 1,000 times more warming than carbon dioxide as greenhouse gases.
And these HFCs are discharged or formed because of refrigeration.
Yeah, we make these chemicals because they are the chemicals that sort of run around inside the refrigeration system, you know, in those coils. They're the ones performing the heat exchange. They leak different amounts from different systems. Supermarkets can leak as much as, you know, 15-20% a year. And because they're chosen for use as refrigerants because they're so stable, but because they're so stable, they sit in the atmosphere forever. And they're, like I say, they have 1,000 times more, they call it global warming potential. So for every ton of those, it's 1,000 times more warming than a ton of CO2.
Nicola Twilley is with us. She's writing a book on refrigeration and recently wrote about China's cold storage boom for the New York Times Magazine. As this cold chain expands, China is also experiencing huge leaps forward, if I can use those terms, huge leaps forward in energy efficiency and the growth of renewable resources. Now, might some of those efforts help mitigate some of the energy needs that cold storage requires?
Oh, absolutely. You can both make a refrigeration system more efficient and you can power it with clean energy. Definitely. And those don't affect the refrigerant problem, but they do affect the electricity problem, which is 80% of the environmental impact of a cold storage warehouse comes from the electricity use. So you can absolutely do that. The question is, can you do it at the scale? I mean, the thing that is easy to sometimes forget about China is that there are 1.4 billion people there. And if they all have even half as much refrigeration as we do in the U.S., that's an awful lot of clean energy to find and doesn't exist right now.
It's so interesting because I remember, you know, 10 years ago, I guess, conversations about global warming or energy conservation all somehow got to, well, everybody in India and China is now going to want cars. And now the conversation is about refrigeration, something far less obvious.
It's sort of, I mean, and that's why I'm so obsessed with refrigeration. I feel as though we completely overlook it. It's sort of this invisible network that we completely rely on. It's the only thing that keeps our food system in the U.S. running. It's the only way you feed our cities is through refrigeration. And yet most people couldn't take you to the nearest refrigerated warehouse or even point out a refrigerated truck on the highway.
Well, it's certainly changed the way Americans eat. How has refrigeration changed the way people in China eat?
Well, it's very interesting at the moment because, and this is one of the reasons I was so excited to travel to China for the Times, because they're refrigerating in fast forward. They're cooling down the entire food system, but it's so quickly that you see generational shifts in action. So the old folk, I had an old lady teach me how to make dumplings from scratch. And I asked her whether she would rather have a bike or a refrigerator if she could only have one. And she just looked at me like I was stupid. Like, obviously she would keep the bike. I mean, how else would she get around? You don't need a refrigerator. Whereas my 26-year-old interpreter that I traveled around with had no bike, depended on his refrigerator, and lived on frozen dumplings. It's really, you know, the older generation are still shopping in wet markets. They're still shopping every day and cooking it fresh that evening. They're still making these things by hand, preserving things traditionally. If you walk around Beijing, people will be air drying sausages outside their window, for example, things like that. And the younger generation, absolutely not. Don't know how to cook, don't want to know. Very much convenience focused, as we are in the U.S.
Nicola Twilley is a writer currently working on a book about refrigeration. You'll find a link to her article for the New York Times Magazine, What Do Chinese Dumplings Have to Do with Global Warming? And that link is at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special fundraising edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. The Cold War may be over, but underground nuclear missile bases and silos remain. Many are now empty, but not for long. Ed Peden, a peace activist turned real estate agent based in Kansas, sells decommissioned bases and silos. Many of his clients turn them into homes. Ed even raised his family in one. So what is home life like underground? Producer Eric Malinsky brings us the story.
The first time I had the dream was in October of 1984. I was watching a Celtics game with my parents, and the emergency broadcast signal suddenly came on.
From the Oval Office at the White House.
My fellow Americans.
President Reagan told us that the missiles had been launched. There's nothing else we could do. I've talked with other people my age, who were kids in the early 80s, and I know that I'm not the only one still haunted by those days. So I was really fascinated when I read about this couple in Kansas who moved into an abandoned nuclear missile base. I had to see it for myself. I flew into Kansas City and I drove a couple hours west to the town of Dover. I drove up a dirt road until I came to a barbed wire gate. There was a little shack on top of a hill, which was suspiciously large compared to the flat farmland around it.
What do you put above a missile base? An English two-door does not make it here. A log cabin really doesn't fit the scene here. We're still working on that one.
Diana Payton lives here. She's heard it all from the neighbors.
The hole in the ground, the cave, earth dwellers, Hobbit, that's a good one.
Living in a nuclear missile base was her husband Ed's idea. Ed Payton has long gray hair and John Lennon spectacles.
In the early 1980s, I was teaching some current events classes at Topeka West High School, and I was hearing locals talk about the missile site. And I was amazed the place was grown up in weeds. There was metal debris everywhere. It was totally trashed. There was a lot of talk in the news about the possibility of nuclear exchange, and yet this hardened underground nuclear-proof structure was flooded and abandoned and ignored. This made no sense to me.
In 1960, the government spent $3.3 million building this base. They only used it for 5 years, but it was active during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 1983, Ed purchased the site for $40,000. That would be like buying a $23 million home today for $84,000. And the sale went fast. The government didn't care. Even the Soviets knew this kind of missile base was outdated. Of course, it's not abandoned now. We walked down the driveway to a massive garage door, wedged into a hill.
This door is 20 feet wide, 18 inches tall, and weighs 47 tons.
The garage door can't be opened from the outside, so we enter through a little side door. We walked up a corrugated tunnel and then took a sharp left into two rooms that were each the size of a high school gym. The walls and pillars had that military-industrial look, including light bulbs and cages.
Overhead, this entire ceiling is a massive door, weighs 400 ton, that rolled back to the west.
Wait. So this ceiling rolled back?
This way, yes, to the west, yeah. That was supposed to retract in about 25 seconds. And then all of this mechanism back here, this yellow mechanism, the very large chains, would pull the rocket upright.
I know it sounds anatomical.
I have a poem that speaks to this. Unzip the door, erect this phallic-looking missile, shoot it 6,000 miles across the planet.
We walked through another tunnel until we got to this control room. The lighting was really dim. There was a console that was full of dials and switches and buttons. It looked like the set of a Cold War movie.
And this is for an Atlas E rocket. We have the manual here, so we could actually do the launch. See, there's the panel as it is here. Someone unfortunately ripped off some of the very, very most special buttons. But here's a commit button.
And the commit button's actually red.
Yeah. And then here's the rotary telephone where we call the president and ask him if he's sure.
Yes, please launch the missile.
Oh my, I don't know.
The control room was next to the barracks where the soldiers used to sleep. And that's now Ed and Diana's living room.
And my wife particularly thought this is a pretty heavy energy down here. We have brought in spiritual artifacts, artwork, and so forth from many of the world's spiritual traditions. This is a Hindu piece over here. And these are Native American pieces. This is kind of a pagan goddess piece there. These are Islamic prayer rugs.
It looked like the 60s counterculture had staged a sit-in and never left.
We see this entire project here as a transformational symbol.
Maybe, but it's still their house. There's a den with a couch and a TV. They built a nice modern kitchen. The walls are low. Each room opens up to the next. Diana feels very comfortable here.
I hardly even consider the fact that we don't have windows.
But their daughters never chose to live in an underground missile base.
My daughters had mixed reviews on the site, and they had cast parties and birthday parties here where there was a lot of room for dancing and that kind of thing. And then there were other days when their moods were not so buoyant where they would say, "Dad, why do we live in a hole?"
There is a shaft of light coming down through a spiral staircase, and they try to go up to the surface at least once a day. There's even a pond on their property. But as Ed points out, an underground house does leave a small carbon footprint.
If we owned this much space on the surface in a traditional structure, we probably couldn't afford to heat and cool it. But underground, this is a very stable temperature under here.
The old missile base had to be off the grid, so the military built a power plant inside. Ed and Diana weren't sure what to do with this gigantic empty room, so they turned it into a nightclub. They built a wraparound balcony and a stage with theatrical lights.
So there's now chairs all around here and drums. I assume you have drum circles?
Oh, yes, we do. We love to play drums. We do.
United in spirit by the pipe and drum, we are as one.
Before you start thinking that Ed is a complete hippie, think again. In the mid-90s, he started buying and selling abandoned nuclear missile bases, and he discovered something about himself. He's pretty good at this whole capitalism thing. His clients range from data storage companies to reclusive rock stars.
In the beginning, 10 years ago, we were selling lots of properties at $40,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, and there's none of that now. Even the roughest, flooded, terrible-looking place will sell for over $100,000. And the ones that are refurbished are quickly selling in the millions of dollars.
I told Ed about the nuclear nightmares I used to have as a kid. And he had the same experience, the classic Cold War childhood.
I was in elementary school in the 1950s, and then I was in high school, 1961 through 1965, the exact same years that this was an active nuclear site. I remember hearing planes in the sky as a young boy, wondering if this was a good plane or a bad plane. And I think for the first time more than ever, parents could no longer tell their children, "It'll be okay, I will protect you, you're safe." There wasn't that anymore.
Or maybe kids just didn't believe it anymore.
As the windshield melts and my tears evaporate.
And that story came to us from producer Eric Malinsky. If you'd like to see Ed Peden's underground subterranean lair, you can find photos of it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.